4Play boys are back. 4Play presented by BarstoolSports.com. Big week for us. Trent Daddy, what's going on?
Not much. Well, a lot is going on, especially today. Presented by Barstool Sports. That's us, baby.
That's us. Presented by Barstool very happily, very proudly. We have no conflicts with that whatsoever.
Nope.
We got a big week. We've got Patrick Harrington on the show. We talked to him for a good amount of time, about 40 minutes.
Yeah, he was more than generous with his time.
Yep, we're just a week out from Open Championship week. He's won that event twice, three-time major champ. One of the bigger, you know, names that we've had thus far.
Definitely, and incredibly interesting. And I remember watching him on Faraday, David Faraday, who we've had on this show,
yep,
on his talk show, and he's fascinating. He's not just like a guy out there playing golf and then, you know, he doesn't have anything interesting to say. He's very thoughtful, and he has a lot of opinions on things, and he's a very, very good interview.
Big thinker, which if you're a big thinker, you're really going to stick out on the show.
Yeah,
just over the course of the history of the show, you're going to really kind of rise above everyone else.
No doubt about it.
So that was about 40 minutes with him. That's going to be coming up pretty quickly. We don't have a ton else to fill the time with because, like we said, that was pretty long for us, 40 minutes. But we do also have, we got golf cart video, running people over, drama, which we're going to get to. I had a big weekend, a big golf event this past weekend, which I'll touch on a little bit, called the Skokie Challenge. We also got a couple from the galleries. But first, this podcast is powered by our friends at Dunkin' Donuts, the Dunkin' Energy Punch, sponsored, powered by Monster Energy. The big news, crush your day with Dunkin' Energy Punch. We get this podcast. We got to come in here. We got to talk about golf. We got to be ready to go. We got to be firing all cylinders every day. There's no better way to do that than with Dunkin'. Trent, what do you like about this?
I like it. It's delicious. So I am a big coffee guy. I know you're a big coffee guy,
yep,
too. But sometimes you want to mix it up a little bit. Coffee can have a bland flavor sometimes. Not a big I'm actually a black coffee drinker.
Okay.
I don't put any cream or sugar in it. So sometimes I want something a little bit different, and that's exactly what you get with the Dunkin' Energy Punch. Like you said, it's blue raspberry, or the strawberry is delicious as well. So when you want something different, when coffee is just not going to do it for you, you get yourself a Dunkin' Energy Punch, and your day is going to be headed in the right direction.
It is an electrifying combination of Monster Energy drink, delicious Dunkin' blue raspberry or strawberry flavors, as Trent mentioned. You can only get it at Dunkin' Donuts. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participations may vary. Limited time offer. Crush your day with new Dunkin' Energy Punch, powered by Monster Energy, blue raspberry, strawberry flavors, all kinds of good stuff. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. All right. So we got a lot of drama with golf cart videos in general. More specifically, the ones where these assholes run people over.
Yep, and I'm glad this happened today. I don't know. I actually haven't got your thoughts on it yet. We went on the radio, which we might put in some of that audio. But just here between us, you and I didn't really talk much after we went on the radio. But it's good to have this on the table finally, because you and I behind the scenes have been talking about this golf cart assholery for a while now. So it's good to have our actual opinion on tape and like how we actually feel about it.
Yeah, and it's very tricky because we are Barstool Sports. Barstool is all about humor. Funny trumps everything. You know, funny comes first, all of that. And a lot of these different things that we get sent in that we post are inherently funny. I mean, if you first see something and you laugh, it's funny. We're probably going to put it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of been the MO for Barstool all along. Now that we've got these different branches, whether it's us being the golf guys, basketball guys, whatever it is, you kind of carve out your niche and you try to focus on one thing. As golf guys, I genuinely despise the fact that there are people out there that right after their buddies hit a golf shot, they're running them over full speed with a golf cart.
It's insane. That's the thing. That's the difference. Like, if it gets posted on Barstool, that's fine. Like, Barstool's funny. Barstool wants to get their engagement. They want to get their numbers up. That Instagram is a monster. It's just going to keep going. So they post everything and anything. With the 4Play account, at least what Riggs and I thought, we wanted it to be a little more an expression of what we thought should be posted and what we thought should be going on in the golf community. That kind of came to a head in terms of the golf and running people over, which we did not agree with.
Right.
So that was the main crux of the argument, and that's what we hashed out with Dave on the radio. That's what we hashed out with him in his office. That's kind of where we were at, and it just feels good to have our opinion out there that we think those dudes are fucking assholes.
Yeah, and it got to the point where, I mean, every time we would post one or I would see a 4Play account post one, I would cringe and be like, God damn it, we posted another one. But we weren't really 100% sure if we could be like, hey, we're not fucking posting these, because bottom line is Barstool pays for us to sit here and talk about golf, to,
yep,
go on trips, to go to the Masters. All this stuff comes from us being under the umbrella of Barstool, and we love Barstool. That's why we work here. But we didn't really know. We didn't really know how that was going to go. Trent had a talk. We eventually went into Dave's office this morning. Then we were on the radio all damn day talking about it. So it feels good to get it out there. I fucking hate those videos. I also despise most videos where just golf cart fuckery, messing up the golf course in general and making the superintendent's lives miserable. But we are Barstool. We're different. Things that are funny, we're going to post. We contemplate all the time the best way to kind of curate our social media accounts as the Foreplay team. We're not the only people that post on there, but we do, you know, we have a decent amount of say on what goes up and what doesn't for the most part. And, you know, we try to put pictures of really cool golf holes mixed in with really funny golf cart stuff. Sometimes we throw in some interesting stats from the weekend. We throw in highlights from the weekend. So we try to make it a good mix of, like, what we would want to follow. Not just, like, pure shenanigans, which some accounts are. Not just pure, like, golf hardcore PGA Tour statistics, because we're not that at all.
Yeah.
But a mix.
And I think that's a little bit of the separation with between us and Dave. Is I know Dave wants, he just wants to grow, and that makes sense. He hasn't gotten this far because he's dumb. He's a very smart person.
Right.
But he thinks that we are being snowflakes because it's, like, how do I want to say it? He thinks we're just trying to be golf hardos when we think it's not that demographic. There's normal people out there who play golf, and that's kind of who we're aiming it towards, who don't like the golf cart thing as well.
Right, and it doesn't even really have anything to do with golf. It's a lot more like, if this was a trend of like running people over in men's league hockey with a Zamboni, I would be very against that.
Yes.
And I would not want to post those if that's what kept happening, because it's very dangerous and it fucking sucks.
Yeah.
And that's just the way we feel about these. They're awful. And like that would drive, I mean, and so now I have a bounty out. I have a $1,000 bounty on my head. I think that I'm definitely going to get hit.
Yeah, I think so too.
I emailed our people and was like, what is my health insurance situation?
Smart.
Because I'm going to get run over by a golf cart.
Yep.
Best case scenario, I get run over. I get slightly injured. I can sue Barstool and Dave Portnoy, make a bunch of money, but not be permanently injured so I can recover.
Yes.
And then we'll be in good shape.
Yeah. See, this is what's fucked up is one of the main reasons I hate those videos is that when you go out and play golf, you live in fear that this is going to happen. Now you have to literally live in that fear with everyone around you because stoolies are everywhere.
Yep.
It's not just your buddies that are going to do this potentially, which I don't think they would, but now you have to, it could be random dudes coming off a completely different hole and ramming down your guy Riggsy.
Yeah, and a lot of this, you know, people are going to say, or Dave's going to say, well, you kind of brought it on yourself. We had this very phenomenal idea after we had the discussion on the radio show with Dave, the back and forth about running people over with golf carts. I went and got Big Cat scooter and I parked it right outside the radio room, and I was going to run over Dave with the scooter, which came after the Barstool radio team retweeted a tweet that was like, if I don't see video of Riggs getting run over, the internet has failed me. I need that immediately.
Yep.
Which I took as a hit. If you retweet that, that's encouraging people to hit me. So I decided to get out in front of it. I was going to hit Dave with a scooter, which obviously would never do any harm to anybody. It's just a little scooter. It's not going to hurt anybody. Those people run into people on the sidewalk all the time. They just get out of the way.
Everybody's fine.
It would have been a really funny video. We have a bunch of Dave loyalists in the office.
Yeah.
Not a lot of Riggsy loyalists, at least none that were willing to affect this situation. They ratted me out, and then Dave's response was, we're going to put a $1,000 bounty on Riggs getting hit with a golf cart. Again, this is all, legally speaking, going to be very good for me, I think. Yeah. Just hope I don't get hurt too bad when I do get hit.
The beautiful thing about a place like this, Barstool, is that everything is recorded. Everything is on video. So everything that Davis said about the bounty and then the eventual hit of you that is going to happen, I'm sorry to say, will be videoed because it has to be for proof for Dave. So you're looking real pretty right now.
I'm almost not even going to be scared when I golf because I know I'm going to get hit eventually, so it doesn't really matter.
It's like this is either going to be a good shot or bad shot, or I'm going to get hit and I'm going to make a bunch of money.
Eventually, I'm going to get hit, so it doesn't matter. Right. You know. So, anyways, fuck people that, you know, run their buddies over with golf carts. I'll report next week when I definitely get hit this weekend.
And, like, and Gaz also said, Gaz, the guy who runs our main social accounts, this is going to die. This is going to die very soon. It's in, like any other viral trend. We hate it as much as we hate it, but we also have in the back of our minds that it's going to be gone soon. So, anybody out there who is like us, don't worry, it's going to be gone soon.
Moving on. I had a big golf weekend. I was out in the Chicagoland area. I do I'm a part of about, I think, three different kind of Ryder Cups and then a couple of member guests. So I got like five-ish big majors on my schedule every year. This is probably my biggest one.
Okay.
This last weekend. It's called the Skokie Challenge. It's at Skokie Country Club in Glencoe, Illinois. It really started, I'll just touch on this real quickly. I know most people or a lot of people have, you know, Ryder Cup type stuff with their friends. They like to hear about other people's And they ask questions about it all the time. You have any recommendations? How can they be better? Ours started 8 years ago. This was the eighth one. Pretty simply, my roommate and one of my teammates and good friends from college grew up on this course, Skokie Country Club in Chicago. They had 1920 U.S. Open there, won by Gene Sarazen, who beat Bobby Jones by a stroke. So it's a good track. They have the Western Am coming up there soon, which is, you know, one of the top three amateur tournaments in the United States of America. They live on the eighth hole.
Okay.
Really nice house in the eighth hole.
Wow, yeah.
So we legitimately just walk over to the tee.
That's beautiful.
It started 8 years ago. My brother and I, my brother lives in St. Louis. I only see him a couple times a year. We were home for college summer break. We drove up to Chicago about 4.5 hours, played with my buddy and his brother on their course.
Oh, you saw your brother this weekend?
Got to see my brother this weekend.
Awesome. I didn't know that.
So it started just 2-on-2. It evolved over the next couple of years. Now it's 6-on-6.
Damn.
It's the hosts, which is my buddy and his family and one of their good family friends, against myself, my brother, two other college roommates and teammates of mine, and one of their brothers and another buddy of ours. So 6-on-6, very intimate golf tournament. We do Saturday, four ball, you know, 2-on-2. Everything's handicapped. Sunday singles. We won last year for the first time.
Okay.
We had never officially won before. It's their home course. You know, they know the track inside and out.
Yep.
This year it came down to the wire. It came down to the 18th hole. There were two singles matches still on the course, and we were one up in both of them, and we had to win both matches to win.
Yep.
And we ended up coming up just short.
No.
It was the most dramatic finish. A couple of my buddies that were in those matches were devastated afterwards, which is what you want, ultimately. Like, you want that emotion. You want people to care.
You don't want people like being like, whatever.
No, right, exactly. But it's, you know, we have it's the greatest place in the world. It's the coolest weekend in the world. We stay at their house. They're big scotch and wine connoisseurs.
I was following your Insta story all weekend. Big scotch weekend for Riggs.
Not a huge scotch guy, but this is my one weekend of the year where I really dig in and just crush scotch. Like I said, I get to see my brother like a couple times a year, who's like my best friend, so we get to hang out. We played together both days.
Is there a dress code at these types of deals? Because I saw you were looking pretty dapper one of the nights.
So the Friday night is a coat and tie affair, and it's the one time a year, basically, that I wear a coat and tie.
Okay.
The other one is the member guest, so two times a year at TCC, no big deal. But we just wear t-shirts and fucking shorts all the time. So I quickly realize every year that I don't fit into my stuff from the previous year. And I only have like one dress shirt because I refuse to do dry cleaning because I don't wear nice stuff enough.
Right.
So I pretty much scrounged together whatever I got. I was wearing my roommate Lurch, the big clown that we've talked about before. I was wearing his sport coat, which was hilariously
were you
like
swimming in that
a
thing?
A little too big, but like wearable.
Okay.
Yeah, I was swimming a little bit.
Okay.
So I was geared up on Friday, drinking scotch, feeling like someone I'm not. We played the track Saturday, and then I got a message, a DM from a stoolie who was like, hey, there's a couple groups behind you. I caddy out at Skokie. Hope you really enjoyed it. Jack, super nice dude. I was like, why don't you caddy for me tomorrow? So stoolie Jack, big four play guy out there, shout out to him, came out and caddied for my brother and I yesterday.
That's
Sunday.
Awesome.
We shot the shit. We had a good time. You know, there are a handful of people I saw around the course that were big fans of the podcast. So nice to know we got people out there watching our back, protecting us. I'm going to need those people on the course.
That's the thing. We always talk about there's tons of stoolies in all the courses we go to, which is true. You're going to have to, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones. I think you do.
Yeah, I do.
They've got the little birdies out there, the little kids around the city that give them information.
Yep.
That's what the stoolies are going to have for you in terms of people running you over with a golf cart.
Yeah, I was thinking about it because I'm going to have to make sure the people in my group, that all the carts are in my view in front of me. Nothing can be behind me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to make sure whoever I'm carded with that day, whoever my teammate is like the most trustworthy guy in the world, because you have to have my back.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a tough world. You know, Dave really stole one thing from me, which is being able to go out, be outside, play golf. It's peaceful. You're kind of running your own ship, playing your own game, competing against the course. To now people are going to be running me over with operational vehicles on the golf course.
You need like, president, like Secret Service.
Yeah.
Secret Service. That's
basically. so it's tough.
So when we were on the radio, you had said that you were going to, if somebody hits you, you were going to take out a gun and kill them, which I actually think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I know you. I think that's something you would do.
Yep.
What do you think your actual reaction would be if you're not too injured if you don't like break bubbles?
So it really depends. I think if it's one of my buddies or, you know, then that there'll be ample opportunity over the course of the next however many hours where I will like sneak up and just start beating them with a golf club or something. Or, you know, if we go out one night and they like pass out a little early, I'm just going to literally start beating the fuck out of them while they're sleeping.
Love it.
If it's someone I don't really know at all, I'm going to have to track them down. Okay. But I will get revenge. I'm a very vengeful person. I occasionally have some rage built up, so I will retaliate. And it won't be an equal and opposite retaliation. It'll be significantly harsher.
That's a good message to get out there, because before that, it kind of seemed that if you're just going to get hit and those people are going to get paid. Now those people have to think, if I hit Riggs, he's going to physically hurt me.
I'll physically hurt them.
And he's being completely genuine.
Oh, yeah. I'll definitely physically hurt them.
So that's what you got to – badly. People who are going to potentially hit Riggs, you got to weigh that. You got to weigh that out. So up to you.
So that was some of the drama in the office today. There's always something. Dave's fucking finally back from Nantucket. It's just chaos for us in the office.
That's what it is.
Please go back to that fucking island.
I don't think you can.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Touche. So tough, Dave. Anyways, big golf weekend. There was some drama on in professional golf.
Yeah.
We had Jon Rahm wins the Irish Open.
Yep.
That was not the story. The story was another, I think it was the sixth hole. Is that right, Trent?
Yeah.
Sixth hole, we had another kind of marking your ball on the green and then replacing it in the proper spot. Controversy?
Yeah. It should be noted that Jon Rahm won by six strokes. So the two-shot penalty wouldn't have mattered. And I don't know, did you get a chance to look at the footage at all?
I saw it.
What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was completely accidental, but it was a violation of the rule.
So this is the big conversation now, and this is also goes to the belly putters, is they throw the word intent into these rules.
Right.
And that kind of gives people, that gives a guy like Jon Rahm to be like, that wasn't my intention. And there are people like Brandel Chamblee who are like, that's a cop-out. It should be one way or another. And I think I agree with Chamblee. I think he didn't get penalized, but he should have. You can't say I didn't intend it. Like, if I kill someone, if I hit you with my cart on purpose, I can't be like, I didn't intend to do that. And then like, all right, you can walk free.
Right. And so, yeah, I agree with Brandel as well. I mean, you're right. He won by six shots. It wasn't going to matter. And they were trying to make it sound on Golf Channel like, well, if he gets a two-stroke penalty here, then he's only up by four, and it really affects him. Maybe. But he won by six. It probably wouldn't have mattered. But they did get it wrong. I mean, the guy blatantly, put his ball in a different spot.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
No,
that's illegal.
That is illegal.
If you break the rules in golf, you have to get punished for them. And there's video evidence of it. So it's pretty bizarre they didn't punish him. I don't know if they were just trying to avoid all of the USGA, negative press they've gotten over the last couple of years for random different rules violations over different championships, but
it makes it worse when they just don't enforce it.
Right. And what the USGA got in trouble for was with Dustin Johnson being like, oh, we might penalize you, we'll see, and making him have to play with that on his conscience,
right,
instead of just knowing.
They did tell, I saw they told Rahm in the middle of his round, like, you're not getting the penalty, and he was like, all
right,
cool.
Right.
So that's the right thing to do.
And so, right, or one way, even if they had said, you're definitely getting the penalty,
right,
that's better than what the USGA did. So, they got it wrong, but... But Jon Rahm fucking won by six.
He even with the penalty, he would have won obviously by four strokes, and he still would have beat the tournament record by like a stroke. So
okay.
He dominated the entire thing.
He dominated. He went
go ahead.
He went from ranked over 500th in the world a year ago to, I think he's up to eighth now.
Yeah.
That's pretty good pretty good run.
He's having himself a pretty good year. That's of the year. So
yeah, and yeah, he won at Torrey with that hole out for eagle on the 72nd hole. We also had Chesson Hadley, who won the Webb event and then to get him back on the tour, and then sobbed uncontrollably afterwards.
Totally, I love that.
Everybody likes to see that. Obviously, just like I was talking about with my tournament,
when
it really means something.
That.
That's all you care about. That's why we get into it with the LPGA. Whatever's on, if it means a lot to those people, it means a lot to me watching.
Yep.
I want to see that. I want to see how people react. That was great to see. It'll be nice to have him back on the main tour. Xander Schauffele won the Greenbrier. Greenbrier obviously got canceled last year, was back this year, was looking mint. We had people being like, is that Augusta?
It's crazy how they can do that. If you go back and look, and they ran a couple of pieces during the actual coverage of the tournament, it is insane that place looks the way it does. It looks amazing.
Yeah, it's spectacular. We had the Phil Mickelson, you blogged this.
Oh, yeah.
The Phil Mickelson falconry commercial.
I don't know how. Is there much falconry in places that you've been?
Didn't even know falconry was a thing.
I thought maybe in the halls of Harvard there were there's like whispers of falconry.
There might be, Trent. I'm not invited to those halls. You know what I'm saying?
You went to Harvard.
Yeah, but I don't like the halls where they're doing falconry. Like they're not like the kid that got recruited to play ice hockey.
This right here is the difference between you and Francis. Because if I asked Francis, he would be like, I fucking love falconry.
Yes, right.
Fucking love falconry.
Falconry, when that fucking Falcon flew over to his hand in that little commercial spot, I did like 8 rewinds. I was like, what is going on here, Phil?
My favorite part is that it's so casual. It's like it should be there. Like they even list it as the first one, and it's in there with off-roading and golfing and tennis and fucking falconry. And this falcon comes and just lands on this lady's arm. It's incredible.
And Phil talking like, yeah, you're damn right, Phil Mickelson, falconry. He's like, duh.
Like it's very, golf is a very white sport, and that was a very white commercial.
Yeah, that was actually a pretty good finish. I mean, there weren't a ton of huge names. Robert Streb's up there, who's always really fun to watch because of his antics, his reaction. He almost got a little Hideki going on on all of his shots where he's got a hilarious reaction, like he just hit the worst shot of all time.
Mm-hmm.
He made like a double on 13 or 14 or something, so he had a good reason to be kind of delivering some frustrated, disgusted antics.
Sure.
But he's always fun to watch. There were not a huge amount of gigantic names coming down the stretch. Nice to see Schauffele get a win. He's been playing really well the last month and a half or so.
Yeah.
Maybe longer, but he just kind of popped up on our radar. And we got Johnny Miller.
I was just going to bring that up.
Johnny Miller extended to 2018. Huge Johnny Miller guy.
I know.
I love Johnny Miller.
Yep. I hate that you like Johnny Miller.
One of my favorites. I love the way that he just gives it to you. I love that he always mixes in a comment about how great he was.
Yep.
About he could have hit that shot, about how he used to be able to hit that shot, no problem.
We most recently had the Justin Thomas stuff where he was like, yeah, it's good, but what did he say? It was like the Milwaukee Open.
Pretty good for the Milwaukee Open or whatever.
As much as I hate Johnny Miller, it's
good. You know that's a great comment.
It's good to know where a guy stands all the time.
Yeah.
So as much as I hate Johnny Miller and he says nerves all the time, he's a jukebox on Sundays. If you just put quarters in him, he would just keep saying nerves, nerves, nerves.
Yep.
But I do like that I kind of know exactly where he's coming from every time something happens.
Yeah, you know what you're going to get. There's no real big surprises. And I think he's laugh out loud funny. I think he's genuine. I think he means all those things that he says.
Yeah, yeah. He's not pretending.
No.
He is arrogant.
No, super arrogant. And he was for a couple of years there, one of the best players on the planet. So good to see Johnny Miller be in the booth till 2018.
Yeah, I thought it'd be longer than that. I thought 2018. I feel like they're going to just sign him
maybe
forever.
Maybe they don't want to lock him up for two. You know, you got to be a little careful there.
If nothing else, he is polarizing on the internet, and that is what people want. At least that's what NBC probably wants.
I feel like the internet is pretty majority against Johnny Miller.
Yeah.
And, like, all the dads back home watching, like, kind of like Johnny Miller.
I feel this exact way, and you're right, about Bubba Watson.
Yeah.
And Bubba Watson in a vacuum on Twitter is universally hated.
Yeah.
But then if you go out to the golf tournaments when we were at the Travelers, biggest fucking crowd in the world.
Yeah.
So I think people sometimes get lost, I'm a victim of it, in the internet and being like, I'm clearly right because everyone's agreeing with me. But then you go outside of it and people are like, I love Johnny Miller. I'm like, I don't get it.
Yeah, we do. We live in this little corner of the internet that sometimes is not a great reflection.
I like it in terms of Johnny Miller and Bubba because it's like, I'm right.
Yeah, true. Okay, good for you. You're wrong, but you're right. Okay, that's great. All right, next up we got Padraig Harrington. Quick little note about this that we didn't really realize until we started recording, that if you're in Europe, where he was, there is a long delay. So a couple second delay, which Sunshine was able to cut a lot of those out, but we were not really able to have necessarily a conversational back and forth.
It's very strange to talk to someone on a delay because, as you're saying, it's not conversational whatsoever. So with this interview, mostly we lobbed him questions and he gave answers, very, very interesting answers. It's a very good interview. It's just that it wasn't as conversational because of the delay.
Yeah, we're not very professional, so we kind of had to scrap what we thought it was going to be mid-interview. Because it was almost like we just emailed him questions.
Yeah.
We ask, wait for 3 seconds, he starts talking, then sometimes you come up with another thought, and then you realize he doesn't get that thought until like 5 seconds later.
Right.
So it was
we're making it sound like it's terrible, like it's really bad. It's going to be fine. The interview is really good. It's just that was our mindset going in, and we had to kind of change up a little bit.
Yep. And he's got his little, his Gaelic going on, the Irish accent.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I love. I think everybody loves that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But focus in, listen to what he says. He's got really, really, really good, interesting stuff.
Yep.
This is Padraig Harrington. Thanks a lot for calling in. We really appreciate it. We're big fans. Where are you at right now?
I'm down in Spain at the moment on a bit of a family holiday. Nice. So the Boltzmann's holiday. I practice a bit during the day and then go to the pool with the kids in the afternoon.
That sounds lovely. It sounds a little better than New York City, to be honest with you.
Yes. I'm sure there'll be other things to do in New York, but I'm sure it's a bit sticky there now at this time of the year.
Yeah, sticky is the perfect way to describe it. So, yeah, like I said, you know, we really appreciate it. We're big fans. We kind of want to just get started going back, you know, kind of to your roots. You're obviously a Dublin guy. I know you grew up the youngest of five sons as, you know, one of the youngest or the youngest in my family. I feel like being the youngest of five sons probably built up a lot of that competitiveness you got.
Oh, there's no doubt. Being the youngest of five sons, I was always, I suppose, a good role model with my older brother. I was always trying to catch them and beat them, whatever we did. Plus, being the youngest means I got all the opportunities. As I often say, my older brothers, when they were teenagers, all would have had part-time jobs, but by the time I became a teenager, you know, there was plenty of pocket money in the house, so I didn't have to do anything. I just played golf.
That's nice. That's a nice little opportunity. And you also grew up, you know, you kind of went to the same school as Paul McGinley, who you would, of course, go on to, you know, play on multiple Ryder Cup teams. What was it kind of like for, you know, the two of you to kind of, I guess, grow up on the professional golf scene and kind of watch each other's success coming from the same place?
Well, you know, it's strange. We were 5 years apart in the school, so I wouldn't have known Paul McGinley when he was in the school, but the area we came from has a number of golf courses. But I don't think myself or Paul would have told anybody when we were in school necessarily that we played golf. We went to a school that was really a played Gaelic football in our school, and that was pretty much it. So, yeah, golf being considered a, you know, wouldn't have been a hard sport anyway, put it like that, when we were growing up. It's kind of all changed now in Ireland that all the kids want to get into golf here. And they kind of really enjoy it now, and it's reaching the pool to play golf.
Yeah, let's fast forward a bit and kind of get into that, because, you know, you had an incredible amateur career. And one thing, you know, when I was kind of looking back and going through some of my research, you know, you're part of a winning Walker Cup team, 1995, but you entered professional golf, you know, relatively late. You studied accounting in college for several years, kind of debating whether or not to turn pro. Just kind of talk a little bit about, you know, that decision and kind of deciding to turn pro relatively late for a lot of guys.
When I was 18, I finished school. I didn't know what I wanted to do, like a lot of people. I did want to be in the golf industry. I liked playing golf, but I didn't think I was good enough to be a pro. So I enrolled in night course doing accountancy. When I finished my professional exams, well, not when I finished, halfway through, I kind of decided that, not because I thought, still I didn't think I was good enough to be a pro, but I thought I was better than the other guy turning pro, because I was beating them. So I said, well, look, if they think they're good enough and if they're turning pro, I'll give it a go. And, you know, success for me would have been 5 years on the European Tour, finishing 75th to 100th in the order of merit. I would have considered that a great success. I just didn't realise, well, I don't know if I didn't realise, I didn't really think too much about it. So when I get out and tour, there was certainly an innocence about me, and I just played. I kept my head down and played. You know, never looked back. And that was the big key point. I wasn't trying to change anything. I was just doing my thing over and over. I really just didn't get any better. There was a beautiful innocence about my golf. I was a very determined person, but I'm sure if I look back now at the person I was when I was 24, I probably would have predicted that guy wouldn't make it as a golfer.
I'm curious. You say you had some doubts of whether you could make it or not. You just said it there when you were 24. You didn't know if you could make it. Where does that doubt come from? Because obviously you're a very accomplished golfer now. Where did that doubt start to seep in when you were younger?
The one thing I've done well in my career all the stages is I've always managed to dominate in my locality. So I would have started out dominating as a junior in my golf club, then in the local golf clubs, then I would have moved up to the county and province and then the country. And then once I finished that, I moved into the youths and the senior level. When I was 18 years of age, I didn't get picked in the top 20 junior golfers in Ireland. Now, I was the best, but I didn't get picked.
Right.
So all I can say is I didn't have a pretty game, but I won. I continued to win. My I would say my greatest achievement in my career, well, can't say it's my greatest, but one of my great achievements in my career is I never lost a single campaign for my country at senior level for 6 years. So every best player that I had in Great Britain and Ireland, and in Europe, when I came up against them in a match for those 6 years, I beat them in when I was playing for the country. So that's what gave me the belief that I could turn pro, that I was beating the best that Europe had to offer. What wouldn't have given me the confidence is, you know, while I could get the job done, I wasn't exactly, I wasn't a good ball striker, I wasn't a good swimmer at a golf club, I wasn't a pretty player. I was effective, but I wasn't, you know, I never played a professional golf event until I was 24 years of age. Nowadays, the good players are playing at 13 years of age. So you right. can understand, I could beat anybody at any stage, you know, in a one-off match. I just didn't really, I don't know, maybe I just didn't look the part. So I didn't necessarily think that I was a big star in the making.
So you came out, you won pretty early in your career. I believe it was your 10th event. Were you thinking at the time, like, oh baby, this is going to be pretty easy?
No. What happened is, and this is the biggest thing to my success as a professional golfer. I was in Nairobi playing a Challenge Tour event. I got a late invite to play a European Tour event in Durban Country Club in South Africa, the PGA Championship in South Africa. I travelled. I think six guys at my venue refused to travel. I travelled. I got sick, very badly dehydrated on the Wednesday. I'm sure nowadays I'd be on a drip and all those things, but 20 years ago, I just shivered my way through the night. I had a late tee time, luckily. I played with clubs that were 4 degrees too upright for me. I just got a brand new set of clubs. Everything could have gone wrong, went wrong for the week, but as I was prone to do at that time, I chipped and put in every hole, which was a given for me. I really didn't think that was... I thought that's what you did. And at the end of the week, I finished 48 and I won £1,460. I rang my mother and I said, I cannot believe I could finish, make the cut and finish 48 in an event playing the way I did. And they're just giving this money away. I won £1,460. And it just was such a boost to me that I could feel like I didn't play my best and still belonged. And I think all these rookies coming out, the hardest thing for them is to feel like they belong. They all come out trying to change things, trying to make themselves better, trying to play at their very best. Whereas I got my first tournament, I played at my worst, which what I thought was my worst. Obviously it wasn't. What I thought was my worst, and I still made the cut. I still belonged. And that just gave me tremendous confidence going forward, and I made my first six cuts, then I made three top tens, and then I won, and all because I never looked back, I never questioned, I just kept playing, never really, you know, didn't get into it. As I said earlier, there was a beautiful innocence about what I did, and you know, I did that for 2 years, where I just ran with the ball and never looked behind me.
So in 1999, you know, you finally qualify and make your first Ryder Cup team. It's in Brookline. You're kind of right in the lion's den there of the Americans. Everybody talks about how there's nothing like Ryder Cup pressure that first tee. What were kind of your feelings? You know, you had some international experience on the amateur level with the Walker Cups and all that, but what were your feelings like going into that first Ryder Cup?
Very similar to Walker Cup. You know, pressure is the same. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're playing for your club championship or you're playing in the Walker Cup, you're playing in the Ryder Cup, you will feel the same pressure. The difference in the Ryder Cup is you could feel that pressure. You know, normally if you're feeling the pressure, you're actually pretty much leading the event, so you've played well for 63 holes, whereas in the Ryder Cup, you could be asked to play well on the Sunday and haven't played badly on the Friday and Saturday. And that's tough. You know, there is a huge pressure in the Ryder Cup, a huge focus. And you're not 100% sure where your game is at. Unlike other weeks where you have all the, you know what you're doing. By the time you get to the last 9 holes of the tournament, you pretty much know what your game's like at that stage. Whereas in the Ryder Cup, it's much tougher. Now, I qualified literally 2 weeks before, so I was on hot run of form, but I will say, like the Walker Cup, my very first shot in the Ryder Cup, by the time I got to hit it, it was a 7-iron off the first fairway, I literally couldn't see the ball. I was that nervous, and I really do mean I couldn't see the ball. Thankfully, both in the Walker Cup and there, I hit good shots, which again is a nice affirmation that when I really get the most amount of pressure, that I still can perform. So that was good. As I said, it's nerve-wracking.
Do you remember that year thinking on Sunday that the USA team shirts were the ugliest shirts you'd ever seen?
No. I was too caught up in what I was doing. I really was. My match, I think I was like maybe 7 in the order, and I was the first blue number on the board. Everybody above me was red, but I never looked at the scoreboard, so I didn't realise how bad things were. I was just playing my game. I only realised, well, not that I realised, but everybody surged around my game around the 13th, 14th hole. David Zavala just won the match in front of me, and then like literally it was 10 deep, and they were screaming at Mark O'Meara that they needed his match, because they all thought my match was the match, because they assumed with a lack of about being 3 up with 6 to play that he was going to beat Justin Leonard, so they assumed I was the pivotal match. I remember the pressure, but I remember thinking, yeah, they're really pushing the pressure onto Mark O'Meara. Telling him that it all falls on his head, that it all rides on him, is not helping him play. It was intense, and probably the most intense experience I've ever had in the golf course. Those last 6 holes of Brookline. It's like being at a football match, and we don't experience that too often. Thankfully, I got across the line and won a win. I don't think I've ever been as excited in my life. I remember doing an interview on the 18th green, and then I ran down the 18th fairway to the 17th green. Now, I say ran, I probably glided. I was on such a high. And I just got myself sat down. People just congratulate me on the win. Just sat down at 17. And I wouldn't say it wasn't 30 seconds later when Justin Leonard held that putt and took all the glory away. I was thinking I'd just won the Ryder Cup for Europe, and then 30 seconds later, it was all done.
Yeah, and that was that was one of the crazier, more crazy moments in the history of the Ryder Cup. Do you kind of remember your reaction to, the Justin Leonard putt reaction and the controversy and the U.S. team on the green? What were kind of, what was kind of going through your mind as that was all unfolding?
I look at these things. I take a different look. I actually think definitely a different side. That just shows how much the U.S. wanted to win.
Right.
They got excited. And isn't it great to see the U.S. getting excited? Up to 99, the U.S. players have been accused of not caring about the Ryder Cup, not putting it into the Ryder Cup. But they showed there on that 17th green that they cared, that they wanted to win, that it's a big deal to them. And I think Europe and everybody in Europe, the greatest achievement in the Ryder Cup is the Europeans that succeeded in doing is making the U.S. really care deeply about it. And it was shown there in the green. They got excited. They ran in the green. Great. Not a big deal.
Right.
It really isn't. And if somebody did something on purpose, or if somebody was underhand, they ran. They just got excited. And that's nice to see. And a lot of people care about the Ryder Cup that they do get excited and get ahead of themselves like that. I was on the side of the green. I assumed the match was over. I think the only person who didn't assume it was over was Jose. But golf is great. It would always be like that. We'd be delighted that people would be passionate and excited. And so the Europeans can take credit for having pushed the U.S. into that corner that they really do care about the Ryder Cup now.
I think that's an awesome way to look at it. And that's a good point. There have been moments, even I think early in Tiger's career, where people really questioned how much he cared about the Ryder Cup, whether guys like that thought they should get paid for it, whatnot. And then, like you said, seeing all that passion, people care that much, is really what the event's all about.
Yeah, pre-99, they were talking about getting paid and all these things. They showed in 99 that they cared, that they wanted to win, and Europe has to take credit for that. It's the Europeans who turned the Ryder Cup around and driven it to where it is now. I've been privy after recent Ryder Cups. I've been in the team rooms with European players and US players. We mix a lot better now than we did back in 99. Players get on very much so now. But I've been in those team rooms afterwards. And you can see the despondency on players, when their team is lost. And you can see the joy in other players. You can see the young guys not actually knowing. That's one of the other beauties of the Ryder Cup. You see the young guys on a losing team And, you know, you don't realize at this stage what it all means. And you see some of the more, the veterans who have lost enough Ryder Cups that they really care. So it is, you know, the Ryder Cup, it's a fantastic experience for everybody. But, you know, at this stage, what you see on the TV has, you know, it's Seve and the likes who drove it to that nature. But thankfully now, in this day and age, there's no bitterness between players or anything like that. We actually all get on very well. We play very hard during the tournament. There's plenty of conspiracies during the tournament, as there always is. But, you know, come Sunday night, we generally all celebrate together.
Which, again, I mean, that's what the event is all about. So so it's, you know, it's great even as American guys to kind of hear you speak about the event like that. Let's move on to, you know, the next Ryder Cup, 2002, and then, you know, you guys kind of go on a tear. You're part of four winning Ryder Cup teams from 2002 through 2010. How much different was that 2002 experience like, where you guys win, you win on European soil? How much different was that from 99?
It was a huge win for us because of the fact we lost in 99.
Right.
You know, we lost the unassailable lead in 99. And then, like, 2002, and then, you know, it's so important for Europe to win and get some momentum back there, that winning feeling back in 2002, home soil, everything goes with it. And then to come back to 2004 and win in the US, you know, that really, really backed it up. Pushed us on so much. I think Europe was highly motivated with those two Ryder Cups. Highly motivated. We were, I think, as good a team and as driven a team as you'll ever come across in 2002 after losing in 99. And then again in 2004 with the opportunity to win in the US soil, which is, it's very hard to win the matches now when you're away from home. You know, with the home setup and things like that, it is tough to win away from home. So to do it in 2004 was really big. Obviously, then we came back in 2006. I think, you know, history will just show that in 2006 we just had a better team. That was just the way it was. It was a very nice Ryder Cup in Ireland. Everything was good about it, but ultimately we just had a better team that year. The 2002 was big for the losing in 99.
So what are your thoughts on kind of the Ryder Cup crowds? You know, the last 4 or 6 years, there's always controversy every year, whether they're over the top or whether it's just kind of a natural evolution of the event. How do you feel about the crowds in the Ryder Cup these days?
Well, all I know is my friends watch the Ryder Cup because of the crowd. Because of the divisive nature of the tournament, because of the atmosphere. And we all get excited about it because of the atmosphere. So I wouldn't be picking the players today. It's not like it's every week you say, it's a different event of Ryder Cup. Yes, I was there at the last Ryder Cup, and, you know, I heard estimates of 5%. It wasn't 5%, it was 5 people out of 60,000 or 40,000. That was, you know, it was very, very little.
Right.
Yes, ultimately, we'd like to avoid anybody shouting or interfering with players before they hit shots. I personally, as a golfer, would never do somebody or anything like that. But the Ryder Cup, it's not like anything's going to, you know, anybody shouting something at a player in between shots, you know, doesn't make any difference. It's not like they're pulling over the ropes at a player, you know. And obviously, if they get used, if they get removed, but I just don't think the atmosphere is very important. And as I said, the neutral is watching it because of the atmosphere, and even the partisans are watching it and wanting a little bit of middle. You know, if it wasn't there, we'd probably call it the President's Cup.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I'm just thinking about the Rory-Patrick Reed match, and I mean, one thing that made that just unbelievable on top of their golf was the crowd reaction to all their shots was unbelievable.
Yeah, we clearly we don't want people interfering before shots. Clearly we don't want people saying, you know, anything that's, you know, downright, you know, rude. You know, why would you do that? And, but it is controlled. People who were out of hand were removed. You know, and there wasn't very many. Obviously, they get a lot of focus, you know, but there wasn't very many. So, you know, I'd be all for it. We've got to still have strong crowds. That's why people watch it. That's what's exciting about it. There's a little bit of conspiracy involved in the tournament. That's why that's what gets it going. You know, it's not a... It's a tough, strong match. The greatest thing about it, though, and this is what I like about it now, I think it's improved, the players, we get on very well. So there's no niggle between the players. We play really hard in the matches, no doubt about it. But as I said, on Sunday night, we're mixing together. The players, we don't carry on after the event. I think we all mix with each other now. So much we play the same event, so much that we're familiar with each other. But I think back in the early days, you know, there was genuine animosity between teams after they carried on for weeks afterwards or whatever. Now that doesn't happen.
Which way do you like it? Do you like it with there's a little bit of animosity, or do you like it now that everybody gets along?
I think you play hard, you play fair. But you know, when it's done, you shake hands and there's no animosity. And I think that's the way it is. I think there is conspiracy theories always during the event. You know, there's always they set the pins up here, they did that, they had this fourth, this way, they cut a bit of rough here. And, you know, all sorts of silly things happen during the week like that. But once the tournament is over, as I said, for the last number of Ryder Cups I've been at, both teams have partied together afterwards.
Yeah, and I think you nail it even from the fans' perspective. I mean, we really like to see you guys getting into it and really, really wanting to beat the other guy. But even nowadays, you know, you see pictures come out after the Ryder Cup of the teams celebrating together, congratulating each other, which is really awesome because it's what it's all about. And like you said, I mean, you guys are playing with each other every weekend, so it's not realistic to buy any of these conspiracy theories that everybody hates each other or any of that.
Yeah. No, they don't. They don't think, you know, I think there was animosity years ago, but not now. I don't think the players now, they know each other, they know everybody's personalities at this stage. So, you know, nothing is taken out of hand or out of context anymore. And, it is great to see that, you know, as I said, when it's all finished on Sunday, you shake hands and you get on with it. And as I said, for the last number of years, we've all ended up partying together.
So let's get into a little major championship talk. We've got the Open Championship coming up in a few weeks. You, of course, seven, had your breakthrough major win at Carnoustie. Trent and I here were not big Sergio Garcia fans at the time, so we were rooting heavily for you, and you've always been a huge fan of ours ever since. So thank you for winning that. But just getting into that, you know, what was kind of your mindset going into that week? Because you've talked a lot about how, you know, there's certain innocence to whenever you played really well. Was it the same type of vibe for you going into Carnoustie that week?
Well, you know, I would have been at that stage one of the biggest leading players not to have won a major. And I think the previous year is where my run really started. I had three pairs to win at Wingfoot. I know most people remember that as the one that Monty missed the green in the last and Phil got in trouble. But I was playing the best golf of my life and I needed to par the last three holes and I would have won. Would have won like a bogey and two pairs would have got me in a playoff. So I played well enough there to win the US Open without anybody's help. And that was the first time I think I realised I was good enough to win a major without it being a lucky leak. So I was going into Carnoustie, I was going into all the majors at that stage, knowing that my game was good enough and just trying to make sure that I prepared right. Give myself the best chance of producing my form that week because my form was good enough. I think in previous years, and you still see this with players, you know, they're trying to have a special week. Well, I was just trying to have a normal week back in Carnoustie, and sure enough, it paid off. I could see it happening from, as I said, Wingfoot was the biggest eye opener to me that I could be that close to winning a major without much having gone right for me that week at Wingfoot. So, going into Carnoustie, I got my preparation right. I won the previous week at a small tournament in Ireland, played some mixed golf there. And I was in good form. Not everything went right during the tournament, but I was played great in the weekend, particularly. Hit the ball very well, played phenomenal on Sunday. Missed a lot of putts, actually. Missed a lot of chances for the first, 17 holes, and obviously had the one shot lead coming down the last, and mess it up, which always left a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth to mess up the 72nd hole when you have a one-shot lead. That's not how you dream about winning when you're a kid. Obviously, reality is you win any way you can. But, you know, having the chance in the playoff is nice. I played great in the playoff again, just like I played those first 17 holes, which a little bit of redemption. I think coming back and winning the following year in Birkdale was a lot of redemption for me. You know, my first major was very exciting. No doubt about it. The first is always going to be exciting. My second major was exactly how you would dream about winning one as a kid. It's very, very satisfying. I played well. I was favourite. Swung the club well. I did a spectacular shot in the 71st hole. Had a four-shot lead coming down the last. Got to go to the crowd. So, yeah, first one was exciting. Second one was very satisfying. And third one, I do still.
As American guys, we look a lot of times at the U.S. Open or the Masters as perhaps being the most meaningful. You know, as an Irish guy, is the Open Championship and being able to win it twice, is that the most meaningful thing for you in golf?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up watching, you know, 12 hours of that when it was on Thursday to Sunday. That was the one we got covered. That's our, it's called the Open for the very reason that it's open to, you know, to all nations. It's distinctly not the British Open. And you know, yeah, we all feel like we have a bit of a part. It's the home of golf, the tradition of golf. You know, it's what golf was originally designed and meant to be like. And it would be a miss in your career if you didn't win it. I would understand as well if the U.S. player decided that the U.S. Open was more important because it's his home
right.
major. But for everybody outside of the U.S., the Open Championship is the one for sure.
So with the Open returning this year to Royal Birkdale and next year to Carnoustie, are you kind of licking your chops a little bit over there?
I'm really keen, actually. I like my own game at the moment, so I'm really just focused on getting my preparation right. And you know, I'm dangerous, but that's what I'm thinking about. And I'm thinking about just getting my head in the game. And it takes at least 2 weeks, but I'm giving it the extra couple of weeks this time. So it takes 2-3 weeks to get your head in the game. You know, it's not a light switch. You can't just turn off the week of a tournament and hope to be, mentally focused. You really have to build your way into that.
Yeah, and you're coming off, of course, the kind of fluke injury from giving a lesson and all of that. First of all, what exactly went down with that?
Yeah, I've obviously had a disc replaced in my neck this year. That took me out for 4 months. And then when I came back, just at the end of the second week, just starting to get into it, I got hit in the elbow where I was giving somebody a lesson. The guy was very nice to send me on some ice hockey elbow pads as a gift afterwards. it's broken my ear up. There's no doubt that I've been struggling with the getting some rhythm into my game. I don't mean, you know, swinging rhythm. I mean just playing rhythm. I've played 25 rounds of golf since last November. 25 rounds of competitive golf. So I'm missing out on that, but I've got two more tournaments before the Open, and they're important that, you know, I get some competitive rounds under my belt. And hopefully, as I said, I'll be physically and mentally ready to go.
We've got we kind of brought up the Masters a little bit earlier. We got to ask you, you've finished or tied, or you've won or tied for the win in the par 3 contest 3 times. We're kind of thinking maybe it's time to hit a couple in the water in the par 3 contest.
I am anti-superstitious. I want to be the first guy to win the par 3 and the Masters. And I laugh at anybody who can logically come along and try and tell me that there is such a thing as superstition. It's just bizarre. I know there's such a thing as superstition, but there's no truth in it. That's it. But it does. There's a placebo effect. So people who believe in stuff like that, there is a placebo effect. There's no doubt about it. There's lots of things that have been shown to work. The more you believe in it, it's outside your hands. Obviously it reduces the pressure. So I just logically, maybe it's, it's certainly my mindset. I don't think it's necessarily my accountant's background, but it's my mindset that these things are just hogwash. There hasn't been enough Masters Par 3 tournaments to dictate that you can never win a Par 3 tournament and win the Masters.
It's funny you say that, because we were going to ask you if you had any superstitions. We're going to just knock that question off the list. You're not going to, you don't believe in them.
Don't believe, I not only would I not believe in them, I would really fight against them. So I'd be the sort of guy that would, I'd hate to be reliant on superstitions and things like that. Just it would, yeah, that would, but imagine if you had a lucky coin and then you went out in the last round, you lost it midway through the round. Do you just stop playing? You know, this is, people who rely, but as I said, people who do rely on superstitions, they are placebos. You know, they can work in your favor, but they can work awfully against you as well. So I'm just the sort of person, I like to be in control. And I don't like to take any outside factors dictate that if I don't wear my lucky underpants, or if I don't wear, have my lucky coin, or if I don't pass my lucky car tax, or none of those have any difference.
It does.
Obviously, some people.
It does seem. It does seem like the people only believe in superstitions when they work, and then when they don't work, they just don't pay any attention to those times.
Yeah, well, that's okay. If they're good enough to not pay attention when they don't work, that's fine. There's some big superstitions, but people lose a lot of belief to try and reduce the pressure on their own game. You know, believe in divine powers, they're controlling everything. I believe it's about me doing my thing. I'm in control. I can see the randomness of things because it's such a small sample. Playing 18 holes of golf or playing one shot in golf or one putt in golf, it's such a small sample over time that's what shows up, the randomness. But I believe it's me. I believe it's all me, and I understand that these things can vary, and that if there was a divine power controlling things, I wish he would be busy dealing with other things rather than my job.
That's fair. That's a good point. It's a very logical point. So we have to ask, you know, Phil Mickelson.
I do have to throw that out there, that, you know, there's a lot of things in this world that need sorting out, and golf comes right at the very bottom of a lot of lists. So I don't think God really cares about how my golf is going out on the golf course or whether my foot drops or not. I do believe that he's got other things on his mind and other things to work on. So yeah, I'm not the one coming down the AG looking for divine inspiration.
So we have to ask, you know, Phil Mickelson and Bones recently split up after 25 years. We're huge friends of caddies on this podcast. We've had a few on, and, you know, we'll continue to do so. We're always enthralled with the player-caddy relationship. You know, how instrumental has that player-caddy relationship been in a lot of the big moments in your career?
My caddy won me the Open Championship in 2007 without a doubt. So when I hit my third shot into the water on the 18th hole, having a one-shot lead, it's the only time I think I've ever been on the golf course where I felt as embarrassed, I felt as choked, I felt as lost. And in many ways, I've never experienced this, I want to give up. And my caddy, he started saying to me, you know, it's not over yet, one shot at a time, let's play it out, let's see what's happening. You know, all the cliches you could think of. Now, we'd worked on this stuff, but he kept telling me. And I think he had to take the club off me as well, because I was going to hit him with the club. He was talking to me about these cliches, because I just want to end it. But after about 50 yards, I started to listen, and after another 50 yards, I started to believe him. And there's no question about it, when I actually went to hit my chip shot on the 72nd hole, my fifth shot, I was hitting it like a teenager showing off. I was like a 15-year-old showing off to the crowd. I hit this really low, hard speed pitch shot in there from 48 yards. In my head, I was saying spin, 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 and watch it spin. And the crowd all thought I hit over the green. And I was showing off like a kid. I was that much in the zone. And that was purely because my caddy had talked me into it. When a lesser caddy would have just, you know, wallowed in our pity, because I was wanting to wallow in my pity, which is not my normal reaction. But bear in mind, I had a one-shot lead, and this was my opportunity to win. a major tournament, and I was genuinely devastated. So he talked me down, which is a big deal. And, you know, I've seen that with other caddies. I've seen him say the right thing at the right time, say the wrong thing sometimes, or not say anything when they should say. So there's an art to caddy. There's an art to being able to do it, and it's the least important thing a caddy has to do is be able to count. You know, you can teach a monkey to do the yardages. It's the stuff he has to say in between, the confidence in when he gives his advice. It's the confidence he gives with that advice without coming across as, I suppose, how to put this, without coming across as being infallible. You know, the minute I see a caddy who thinks he's infallible, that's a complete no-no, because everybody's human out there. You give your opinion. Caddy's job is to moderate the opinion of the player, not to, you know. So if I think it's a 6-iron and a caddy says it's a 7-iron, well, now I know it's either a hard 7 or a smooth 6. We moderate. That's all you're doing out there. It's not a science. I can easily hit my 7-iron as far as my 6, and I can easily hit my 6 as far as my 7. I can cross over all day. So it's just a question of getting on the same wavelength as your caddy, and then you moderate to pick what is the best shot. And certainly, I wouldn't have a caddy who takes over. I don't like those type of caddies who are trying to hit the shots for the players. Players are good enough to be pros. They should know their own shots. It's a question of, as I said, the fine line touches on those shots.
And again, that's why, you know, we're huge fans of pretty much all caddies. You know, we always try to get them on the show as much as we can and kind of highlight how important they are out there, because sometimes and oftentimes they don't get enough credit. So we have...
It's interesting out there on tour now. I'm pretty much sure if you went at this stage and listed the third level qualifications of the caddies and compared them to the players, I think the caddies would be more qualified educationally than the players. There's a lot of highly educated people who choose caddying as a career now, whereas I think 30 years ago, most caddies fell into it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of good young ex-pros, college players, you know, guys who choose it as a lifestyle, they know what they're doing. The standard is very competitive out there. You've got to be good, you know, to be out there caddying. You'll be found out pretty soon if you're not.
So we have one last question. It's a little bit of a fun one. Do you have a go-to curse word after you hit a terrible shot?
I hope it's good grief. Or golly gosh.
Fair, that's smart.
I know that's what I said when I was a kid in order to avoid cursing. But I will tell you what I do say. Feckadavik.
Okay.
What's that?
Okay. So feckadavik, it sounds like a curse, but it's actually... what a teacher used to show us as kids in Crossdane at the school that I went to, and it means you will see sun. So you will see sun, as in, you know, son of a father. You will see sun. It's Gaelic.
You're right, it does
so
have...
It sounds like a curse.
That's what I was going to say. It has the charm of sounding like a curse word but not being one.
Yeah, well, that's... Well, I don't think you should curse. I don't think you should curse. That's the way it is. You know, we're out there, we're on TV, and there's plenty of good words you can use that are much better than curses. Feckadavik being one of the two words.
I like that. It's very, very commendable, very respectable. All right, Trent, you have anything else?
No, I think that's all we got for Padraig.
All right, Padraig, we really appreciate you taking some time. We know you're a busy guy,
okay.
And we're happy.
You're welcome.
We're happy you're healthy, and we'll be rooting for you the rest of the way.
Okay, thanks a lot.
That interview with Padraig Harrington was brought to you by the 4Play store on barstoolsports.com/4. We got all kinds of good stuff in there.
Yep. I'm looking at towels. I'm looking at four of the boys' shirts, F-O-R-E. We got polos. We got the American guys, which we say every time. Most underrated shirt, but I mean,
it's just such a good shirt.
It is.
If you don't like that shirt, you're an idiot.
One of our guys from downstairs came upstairs yesterday and was wearing it, and I was like, God damn it. That's a great shirt.
Yeah. Also, Pat McAfee wears it every now and then, and I'm just like, that's such a good shirt. And it's essentially timeless, because those guys are going to be dominating American team events for decades.
That's true. And we've also got a couple of tank tops in there, so it's the summer months now, so you want to get out there, show off the guns a little bit at the beach, buy yourself a 4Play tank top.
Yeah, huge fan, again, of the towels. Those have been the number one bestseller. People love those, the golf towels. They're great quality. They look good. You're showing people what you like. Get in there, get yourself some koozies, barstoolsports.com/4. Get yourself into the store. Padraic Harrington was obviously phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple notes. We are no longer going to swear on the golf course.
Nope, because Padraic said not to.
Yep, Padraic said not to, so we're not going to do it. We're also never going to call it the British Open anymore, which I used to love to do to kind of stick it to Europe a little bit.
Same.
But now, I mean, Padraic, I almost cried as he talked about how much the Open Championship meant.
He said it with a little sass, too.
Little sass.
He's like, it's the Open.
Fuck people that call it the British Open, which was us. I don't think he knew it was us, but that was us.
He did.
So we're not calling it the British Open anymore. It's just the Open Championship. We saw the claret jug in the office a couple weeks ago. No big deal. Very nice. You get that by winning the Open Championship. That's what we're going to call it.
Yep. No more superstitions for me, at least. I'm not doing those anymore.
Definitely not a superstitious person anymore.
That was by far my favorite part of the interview, is Padraic just completely just, nope, I'm just, nope, I'm not into that. I don't like it. I think I depend on myself. I bet on myself. If I do something wrong, it's my fault. If I do something right, I did it. It's that, it's that, it's that. I love that.
Yeah, also going deeper, basically, and being like, God doesn't give a fuck about your round of golf.
Yep.
Or how which way your coin's turned in your pocket, buddy. And I was like, that's true.
It's true. God damn it.
Super true.
And it's one thing coming from an average Joe like us if we were to say something like that, but it's Padraic Harrington.
Yeah,
he's got three majors.
I'm pretty convinced now that superstitious people are the dumbest people in the world.
Totally.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
So those are our notes from the interview. Just phenomenal stuff. We loved, of course, how he talked about the importance of his caddy, especially coming down the 72nd hole at Carnoustie after he said he's basically ready to walk off the golf course. Caddy settled him down. He got up and down from... with a little wedge to actually save double, gets himself into a playoff and wins. Huge caddy guys here. If anybody's ever thinks of any caddies out there, big personality caddies, caddies that got interesting stuff to say, we'll try to get them on the podcast. Let us know.
Mm-hmm.
On to From the Gallery. If you've got stuff, email us, foreplay@barstoolsports.com. We got a couple this week, Trent.
Yep, let me start here. It's Drunk Missing Tea Time. This is from Aubrey. Got hammered last night and still figured I'd be able to make my tea time this morning, set like 10 alarms just to make sure I'd get up, but obviously it didn't work. Should my boys be pissed at me, especially since it's Saturday, and what should my punishment be?
You can't miss a tea time.
Can't miss a tea
time. Just can't do it, and I've done it. I got
it. Did you do it with Captain Cons?
Captain Cons did it to me.
Oh, that's right.
No, I did it as a younger chap back in college, and I got invited to play Myopia Hunt Club up in the North Shore, Mass., which is
that got an audible reaction from Sunshine.
It is it's like a top 30 track, often great. Under many people's belief, even higher than that in the United States of America. It's a phenomenal course. One of my really good friends who played on the Harvard golf team grew up a member there, so I got the invite to play with him and his dad on a Sunday morning while we were in college. Didn't make it. Wasn't even close. Slept right through. I was unbelievably hungover, and not even hungover, just not asleep, not awake yet.
Not even conscious
from the night before.
It's like your Vegas flight.
Yep. Never been invited back to that tea time.
That's shitty.
Not
yeah.
even close. Yep. No, they didn't even give me a look. They invite everybody else like out of spite, basically, and I deserve it. You cannot miss a fucking tea time. Captain Cons did it to me, really, like a week after I met the kid, where Trent and I actually, when he was in town before you lived here,
we
had that night out. Friday.
Oh, I had to make a 10 a.m. flight at LaGuardia, mm-hmm. and I got home at 4 a.m. It was awful.
Captain Cons of Zero Blog 30 fame, he pulled an outrageous move, which was where he woke up, was tweeting, and that's when his alarm went off, is when he woke up, and then he fell back asleep.
Oh,
so
no.
When I arrived at his apartment in an Uber to pick him up on my way to the course, no answer, no show. I had never been to his place before, so I didn't know where his apartment was. I couldn't go knock on his door and throw rocks in his window.
I bet you were furious.
Like I was in a romantic comedy. Nothing. I was furious. Uber cost me like $110 to get all the way out to the course. I waited at Captain Khan's place for like 20 minutes.
I love it.
He ended up showing up on like the 8th hole, took his own Uber out there.
Okay, so that's an interesting hypothetical. Do we let that person play?
Yeah, I let him play, but he never gets an invite ever again. And now it's to the point where he texts other guys in the office when I invite them to play, being like, yeah, I didn't get the look because Riggsy's still mad at me for that thing. And it's true.
That's good. I like that world where we live in where it's you make a decision. If you're not there, you're out. You're just out.
So, I mean, I think he's creeping back up to the number one contender list in terms of getting another golf look.
Okay.
But especially because Frankie went downhill fast today with his defense of Dave and Go Preds Go Crowd.
Yeah, that's true.
And Frankie was one of my big guys for my golf invites. So we'll see.
I will say you don't miss a tea time. I agree with you. You just got to think in your head, I'm going to drink when I get there.
Yeah.
I'm going to drink when I get there.
True.
Bloody Mary, I'm a big Bloody Mary right before the first tee guy. So you like get a Bloody Mary and you're fine. You just got to get there.
Agreed. And the problem with missing a golf tee time is that there's no like recoverable thing for the rest of the crew. Playing as a threesome sucks.
Yep.
Especially when you're all jacked up all week. You've been talking about the match you're going to have, 2-on-2. It's going to be really fun. People don't have enough time to replace you. You just fuck over everybody.
Yeah.
And it sucks.
It does.
Next one, Patrick says, thoughts on wearing gym shorts with a golf polo to play a 9-hole round? Just trying to trying to catch a quick round after work and it's hot as balls. What do you think about this trip?
It's going to be a bad answer, but it just depends on where you're playing.
Totally depends.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, and we're reaching that age of golf now where it's a lot more casual, and there are definitely places where you can get away with this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if it's just a pretty relaxed public track and they're not going to say anything or they don't care, totally go for it. I mean, those guys, when they go on that spring break trip to Baker's Bay, mm-hmm. that place is as nice as it could possibly be in the Bahamas, on the water. It's very luxurious, but that course has a wear whatever the fuck policy. That's how golf's evolved.
Do you think those four could wear whatever the fuck they want anywhere, though?
I mean, I think you... Yeah, no, not okay. anywhere, but like...
Yeah, anywhere is too broad.
A good amount of places, yes, but it would still be frowned upon.
Definitely.
Like, don't be that asshole that has to be, like, you know, trying to, I can wear whatever I want, where it's 2017. Yeah. Don't be that guy.
Definitely.
Like, if you're at a certain place, you gotta wear the right attire, but... There's definitely places you can get away with this, especially after work. If it's like 6 o'clock, you're playing a quick 9 holes, you hop out there. Sometimes you hop out there even shoeless, which Trent has done.
I did do that. Where was that? Oh, TPC Potomac.
Yeah, and this guy doesn't even need the collared shirt. He's like collared if I wear a polo with gym shorts. Buddy, if you're gym shorts, you're not fooling anybody with the polo.
No.
Yeah. You're in fucking gym shorts.
Yeah, just go the whole way. Don't try to like go halfway.
Right, and again, so it totally depends on the place. I don't have a problem with it if you're at the right spot. Anyways, on to this week on tour. We've got the John Deere Classic.
Yes.
Very near and dear to Trent's
heart. It is. It's the one. It's right by me. It's in a little place called Silvis, Illinois.
Okay.
I went there a couple years ago when Jim Renner was still on tour with the original People's Golfer, and it was a blast. It's awesome. It's, what is it, TPC Deer Run.
Yep.
Which is, I've played a couple of times.
Okay.
It's,
wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Baby. Me and my buddies make the drive up there every once in a while. Well, not anymore because I don't live there.
Right.
But,
different drive now. Way different drive
it's
for you.
It's a much different drive.
Yeah.
Usually it's about an hour 15. Now it's probably like... 17.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
but it's
definitely
different. This is the one where Spieth got his first win. Everybody was talking about the bunker shot at Travelers. It was very similar to the one at John Deere.
Yeah, when he holed out, he actually kind of thinned that one that was going a little past the hole.
Yes.
One hops into the cup and he ends up winning in a playoff to get his first win.
Right. And then this is the one Steve Stricker won 3 years running a couple years ago.
He won it like a billion times.
Zach Johnson won it. It was great when Zach won it. He's like, I mean.
That was just.
Come on.
Oh.
Zach Johnson won the John Deere Classic.
That was like winning a Super Bowl in your hometown for
it's
you.
True.
Yeah.
It's 100% true.
That's
so
nice.
I like this tournament a lot. Going to it was so much fun. The course is great. The people are great. Obviously, it's the Midwest. So
of course, Midwest. Oh, it was so nice to be in Chicago this weekend, Trent. Just like seeing nice people everywhere.
Yeah.
Interacting with nice human beings.
Well, I don't know if I said it in last week when I was talking about when I was in Iowa, the last podcast. First of all, wide open spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You can see as far as you want. There's none of that in New York.
Nope.
And everybody's just way nicer. I know that's cliche and stereotypical, but it's true. Everyone in New York is, they're not mean. They're just indifferent and they just walk and whatever.
Yep.
They don't pay attention. Everyone back home is pretty nice.
Yeah,
I know. I know New Yorkers are like, oh, I wouldn't like that. Well, fuck you. You're mean.
Yeah, I laugh because there's a bagel shop that I go to, and when I go in there, the lady, when I'm done ordering, just says, swipe the card. She doesn't say please, thanks. She just swipe the card. And I'm like, Jesus Christ.
It's
I'll
horrible.
Swipe the card immediately.
Yeah, I will.
Please don't.
I got it's an insert one. I got to do that. Now.
Right. That's like real awkward. She's just looking at me like, swipe the fucking card, you Midwestern idiot. So anyways, John Deere Classic Week. We're just a week out from the Open Championship.
Yeah, and Spieth's not playing this year at the John Deere. Unfortunately, he's going to get ready for the Open, but that happens.
He's been taking a little heat for that, but that's everything.
Well, he took the heat for last year too, but it was because of the Olympics.
Right.
But it's one of those things where it's a gift and a curse to win that tournament for a guy like Spieth, because normally he would be like, okay, I'll just skip that tournament. It's no big deal.
Right.
But then when you win it, you got to come back and defend it.
Yeah, because there are people who are like, well, without this tournament, you would have never got to
exactly.
where you are. Right.
And then he won it again, I believe, right? A couple of years ago.
I think so, yes.
And then so it's like it's that thing where you're going to take heat from some of the Midwesterners if you skip it, but you want to get ready for the Open. So I understand why he's skipping it. But
yeah, I get it. I mean, it's just kind of BS outrage when people talk about that and get upset with Spieth about that. Who really cares? Yeah, he did win it in 2015 and 2013. So anyways, it's a last little tune-up for the Open Championship. A lot of guys head over there already. Love the Open Championship. It's different. That's the big reason that we want chaos at the U.S. Open is because it makes it different from all the other weeks. We love the British Open. It's links. I'm sorry, the Open Championship.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's going to take a little bit to iron that out of my lingo.
Okay.
The Open Championship, links golf, yep. Royal Birkdale. It's good stuff. I'm pretty pumped. You got anything else, Trent?
No, I'm excited about it, too. I think the Open is sneaky. Might be my favorite major.
Yeah, it's just so different. There's every shot's different.
There is also something to be said for people who watch it stateside where you have to get up at an ungodly hour, but then you're up and drinking coffee at like 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, this is great.
Yeah, you're all fired up for it. And it's nice on the weekend when you wake up from whatever you're doing the night before, and the guys are just like teeing off right when you wake up.
Or you just stay up the whole time.
Yeah, or you try to pull that hero move where you stay up, and then you're like, it just doesn't work.
It doesn't
work.
You're
out of sorts
for
like a week straight.
45 minutes, and then it's over. You're like, it's that type of deal where at like midnight, everybody's like, we're staying up.
Yep.
We're staying up for the Open. We're going to watch them all tee off. It's going to be awesome.
Especially back when in Tiger's Day, where you'd be like, Tiger's teeing off at 1:15.
Yes.
We could do that.
Yes.
You stay up for like two shots, and you wake up like on the couch.
And
like,
bodies just keep falling. And you're like, this was so dumb.
So it's Open Championship week next week. We got 1 week to go. Very exciting stuff right on the precipice. And yeah, that's all I got.
Hit it hard.
Hit it hard. I hit it hard, man. So far, man. No laying up, no holding back. Ain't afraid of nothing, it's a natural fact. I hit it long, man. Till it's gone, man. Keep taking chances, living large. I hit it, hit it, hit it hard. Most people would have given up by now. All the rough I've seen, these ups and downs. Somehow I just keep on playing through. So all you critics, pull up a chair. At the winner's circle soon, I'll be there. With a high five and a smile for you. Hit it hard, man. So far, man. No laying up, no holding. Trying to tell me how to live my life. These lawyers and strings spending money like my ex-wives. Sure, I gamble and I drink and smoke three packs a day. Hell, ain't country music supposed to be this way? It's from the heart, man. I hit it hard, man. So far, man. I hit it hard. I hit it. I hit it. I hit it hard. I hit it hard, man. So far, man. So far. No laying up, no holding back. Ain't afraid of nothing. It's a natural fact. I hit it long, man. Till it's gone, man. Keep taking chances, living large. I hit it. I hit it. I hit it hard. I'll keep hitting it hard, man. How about